Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hello and happy Saturday, everybody. We have a couple of episodes coming up, one of which is a live show about communal living experiments in New Harmony, Indiana. And that started me thinking about this episode from 6 years ago that we did about the Brook Farm community.
Brook Farm actually came after those experiments by a couple of decades, and the ideology of it was really different from Brook Farm. While other attempted utopias claimed to be about equality, there was still a clear division between genders and how the work was portioned out. But Brook Farm, on the other hand, was founded on the idea that women should truly be equals.
Yeah, they also did not discriminate on the basis of color. It was really, they were very, very into the idea that truly every human there was equal to every other.
Also, when we originally recorded this episode, I did not live in Massachusetts, and I imagined that where Brook Farm was located was way further out than it actually is.
But it was super rural
at the time. Yes.
Which we mentioned in the episode. And there are a lot of commonalities in all of these communal living stories, but none of them worked out. I don't think that's a big spoiler. But they all kind of failed in their own unique ways, although they also all had some interesting sorts of successes of their own, even though they didn't long-term survive. So give it a listen.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And today we're going to talk about an experiment in utopian living.
I feel like this has been tried many times in many ways.
It has. And even while this one was going on, there were many, many others going on. So to give you some clues to what we're talking about, from 1841 to 1846, Boston's West Roxbury suburb, which at the time was completely rural, and it is not so much now, was home to this experiment in transcendentalist utopian living called the Brook Farm Community. And I have read at the time that there were approximately 80 other similar experimental communities going on in the U.S.
I was going to say, were they all in New England or were they all over?
I think they were highly concentrated in New England, but mm-hmm. there were a few in other parts of the country. But it is a fascinating concept to think about, like a bunch of like-minded people all kind of throwing in their lot together and trying to live in a community where
you know, they all work together to sort of attempt to achieve a blissful happiness. I see the appeal.
Yeah.
I think, you know, on paper, it's
on paper,
quite
it is
something.
Great. And then in reality,
and as we'll see in practice,
sustaining,
it's a little harder to make that work long term.
Yeah. Well, and sustaining yourself as a community is
pretty
difficult.
And the founder of this experiment was a man named George Ripley. And Brook Farm was really unusual because it was the first community of its time that was secular. There were many utopian societies launching, as I said, but the rest were all pretty aligned with religious ideals. And we'll talk a little bit more about the religion element later. But Ripley was a Unitarian minister, and he actually launched the community with the idea that the residents could pursue their scientific and literary studies there while also working. So he wanted like a working, thinking balance. He and his wife, Sophia Willard Dana Ripley, were heavily influenced by the Transcendentalist movement, which emphasizes a more intuitive spirituality and being highly connected to nature and living outside the trappings of societal rules. There are lots of famous writers associated with Transcendentalism, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and also Margaret Fuller and Louisa May Alcott, and Nathaniel Hawthorne, who plays into this story a bit.
Yes. So the Ripleys envisioned a place of balance and equality, where people could live very closely with the land. And on top of that, class, gender, and age would not play any part in how valuable a person was viewed in terms of the rest of the community.
Yeah, which is, that's a big...
That's a big thing
at the
time. That's
a big shakedown for society. And so how this all got started is that George Ripley and his friend Theodore Parker attended the Christian Union Convention in 1840. And it's at that event that Ripley had the idea for Brook Farm. And this convention was organized in part by a group called, quote, Come Outers. And they were religious protesters who had left their churches to speak out against all sects. Like, they didn't want the separate elements of religion. They didn't see why we couldn't all just come together in spirituality. And other delegates at the conference also went on to form their own utopian societies. So Ripley was not flying solo in getting this idea there. It must have been talked about because several other societies grew out of the ideas that people had while they were at that particular convention. And I mean, many of the attendees were seeing the potential of establishing communities where people could really simplify their lives and shift to a more intuitive relationship with spirituality. And so after that, Ripley resigned from his ministry to pursue his dream of creating a sort of heaven on earth. That was his full-time work at that point, was to figure out a way to make this idea a reality.
So he wrote a letter to Ralph Waldo Emerson in which he described his ideals for what Brook Farm would be like. And he wrote, "Our objects, as you know, are to ensure a more natural union between intellectual and manual labor than now exists, to combine the thinker and the worker as far as possible in the same individual, to guarantee the highest mental freedom by providing all with labor adapted to their tastes and talents, and securing to them the fruits of their industry, to do away with the necessity of menial services by opening the benefits of education and the profits of labor to all, and thus to prepare a society of liberal, intelligent, and cultivated persons whose relations with each other would permit a more simple and wholesome life than can be led amidst the pressures of our competitive institutions."
Again, I see the appeal.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good ideal. And while Emerson also saw the appeal, he was a proponent of Transcendentalism, he actually declined the invitation to join Ripley's group. He felt like the societal changes that Ripley was hoping to catalyze with Brook Farm would actually be better served by individuals instead of groups. And he wrote of it, "All failed to see that the reform of reforms must be accomplished without means." I.e., he didn't really want this big organized group to try to change society. He thought you would do better one-on-one just talking with people.
Yeah, and I think what he was trying to do, you sort of see threads of this today and the whole idea that people should follow their passion and make their career based on their passion. It's sort of a similar idea of like uniting people's work with what's going to be meaningful to them, which, as we know, often does not play out in reality as something that is possible for all people.
Yeah. And Margaret Fuller, who we mentioned earlier, is another writer that's often connected to this movement, was also invited
to participate in Brook Farm, but she declined for the same ideological reasons as Emerson. She just didn't see or didn't feel like this structured group way to do it was really the best way to affect social change.
So the Brook Farm Institute for Agriculture and Education was established in 1841. And Ripley had figured out that he was going to need $30,000 for the land and the buildings and to support the community for its first year. So he financed his vision by selling shares of the farm for $500 each, which would later prove to be a very bad plan. And he took contributions from like-minded philanthropists. He bought a 200-acre dairy farm in West Roxbury, adjacent to the Charles River, for $10,500 on October 11, 1841. He didn't have any knowledge of farming, and so he started to study agriculture as he planned the farm.
And most accounts will also say there's a reason it was a dairy farm, which is that it had really awful soil for actually growing crops. Yeah, so they did focus on the dairy part, but it may not have been the purchase that a more seasoned farmer would have made.
No, and the fact that someone who has no knowledge of agriculture is trying to start a community that's going to sustain itself by farming sort of sets the stage.
Yeah. And then they really got to the point where they had the land and they had to figure out the actual logistics of how this farm was going to work. So, you know, they had the ideals of transcendentalism, but the Ripleys really like had to figure out how is Brook Farm going to function. And they had decided that the main farmhouse on the property, which was going to be called the Hive, would serve as the primary dorm. And it also had a lot of the social spaces. There was a community school, which eventually moved into a building called The Nest, and it was run by Sophia Ripley and her sister-in-law, Mary Ann, and it was designed to educate future citizens. Jobs would be arranged based on affinity, so people could choose their work. As he had said in his letter to Emerson, they were going to try to make people able to do the jobs that most appealed to them so they would be most fulfilling.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The work week required 60 hours from the months of May to October, and then 48 from November to April. They'd also change jobs frequently to keep people from getting bored, and do lots of stuff to try to make the tasks intellectually stimulating and enjoyable.
There's actually a story.
Please tell me, because I...
About them attaching little reading stands to, like, ironing boards so that people could be doing their sort of menial ironing tasks that had to get done and the laundry. But at the same time, they could be broadening their minds and reading things that were of interest to them.
Yeah, I was sort of imagining a 19th century gamification of milking or something.
Mostly lots of reading.
And that's cool. all of the labor, regardless of who was doing it, got the same compensation. And for people who weren't working, the rent was $4 a week.
So you could go and be at Brook Farm as a boarder and not work, but you would have to be paying for your room and board. And there's a really unique thing about Brook Farm in that it almost entirely broke the role of women as housekeepers, which, keep in mind, 1840s. So this is really pretty revolutionary in terms of how the roles of women and men are defined. But Erin McEmeris, who is a scholar who was writing for the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society, made an interesting note about this particular element. And he says there really wasn't a household to keep. There weren't, at least at the start of Brook Farm, many family units. So the majority of the participants were young and unmarried and without children. So in terms of keeping house, and it wasn't quite the same as if someone had moved in with, like, their three children and, you know, they had to make sure the kids were clothed and the, you know, toys were picked up. And it was a little bit easier when it's all young singles to kind of have everybody doing their own tidying and not have to really have a housekeeper per se.
So there were 20 people to start. But that number quickly got a lot bigger.
Yeah. And it waxed and waned a little bit as Brook Farm went on. But I don't think it went down to that small a number again until the end. But the interesting thing that happened is that once the initial enthusiastic optimism of life in a new utopia wore off, it seems that the members of Brook Farm kind of separated into two categories. One was the people that were happy there and kind of found this simple life very fulfilling, and people who realized that farming is hard and they didn't really enjoy this whole toil thing. They were like, oh, life of the mind. That sounds great. Wait, shoveling manure?
Yeah. Well, that 60-hour work week quoted before.
Yeah.
A lot of people today would find a 60-hour work week to me
horrible
a lot, and it's not like 60 hours of sitting at a desk. Like, we're talking 60 hours of, like you were saying, spreading manure and plowing and
keeping a farm going is a lot of man hours.
It's
hard labor, and a lot of these people were not accustomed to hard labor. Like I said, they came into it from the intellectual mindset of, like, oh yes, we can live with the land and in the meantime we'll be reading all the time and studying. But they didn't get that whole, like, we're gonna have to cultivate the land
thing. Yeah, we grew all of our vegetables when I was growing up. Like, I don't think we ever bought vegetables at a store.
Oh.
And it was really constant work.
Yeah.
For pretty much me and my brother and my mom for the entire spring, summer, and fall.
Yeah. I mean, I grow very small amounts of things, and I feel like, man, why does this take me an hour a day just to, like, check on plants and weed? And that's my tiny, tiny little container garden. So, of course, on a farm,
much
that's
longer.
60 hours is actually probably a pretty reasonable number.
Yeah.
But the people that fell into that second group of farming is hard did not stick around. Nathaniel Hawthorne was one of them. I think he's reported to have only been there 6 months. But those that remained referred to that disillusioned group as, quote, idealistic tourists, and they criticized their lack of commitment to the project and their lack of community spirit.
So as the group got bigger, they needed more buildings, and financing them proved to be kind of a problem.
Yeah, before long, the community found itself in $15,000 worth of debt, which, again, by 1840 standards, is a lot to have to make up because right. They were hoping this would be a long-term situation.
By 1842, there were 70 people living at Brook Farm. And it was a success in that it was drawing new people to live there, but the expense of caring for the new people was beyond what they could financially handle, especially because a lot of these newcomers didn't actually make good on the investment agreements that they had made to come there. So because many of the idealists involved in the community also found money to be distasteful, there wasn't really somebody who was just going to take control of the finances and make people pay up.
Yeah, so that thing that we mentioned earlier about it being like a $500 buy-in, like you would buy in your share, if nobody's actually giving you their $500, and it was much more of a problem with people that came in later than the people that started out. But if nobody's actually doing their part to, you know, bolster the finances, then you're really just hemorrhaging money at that point. The Nest, which was operating as a boarding school and had an excellent reputation, was really the source of most of the community's income. But even so, it didn't provide enough to cover day-to-day costs, let alone the expansion plans that they were going to need to house all of the new people coming in.
So from 1843 to 1844, George Ripley became more and more interested in a new vision of the utopian society, described by French philosopher Charles Fourier. So Fourier's concept of communities where social and commercial competition could just be completely eradicated really appealed to Ripley. And he thought if he could reorganize Brook Farm to be more in line with Fourierism, he could solve some of their problems by attracting new members and new financial support. So the Brook Farm concept had always been a little bit at odds with the individualism that was part of the Transcendentalist movement. And that, as you recall, is why Emerson wasn't interested in being a member. But Fourier's utopia smoothed out that particular wrinkle.
And in 1844, Brook Farm officially reorganized as a, quote, Fourier phalanx, which is a name he used for his concept of these communities. But the remaining members who still valued transcendentalist individualism left the community. This was actually not like a quick and easy transition. There was some infighting and arguing and some rifts that, you know, caused people to leave.
Under this new structure, the organization became a lot more rigid. Associates were organized into groups under larger series divisions. There were three series, and they were the agricultural, mechanical, and domestic industry. Each group formed in any series had to be arranged using so-called harmonic numbers. So a group had to have 3, 5, 7, or 12 members, but not 4, 6, or 8. In her history of Brook Farm, Linda Swift says this was, of course, stark lunacy. There were rules upon rules about how the business of these series and groups was supposed to be conducted. And it was this huge departure from the really intuitive approach that the community had been founded on.
Yeah, it really completely changed how the whole thing was working. Because it had been, you know, so much of a relaxed kind of atmosphere. And now suddenly there were, you know, all of these guides about how business was going to happen and how foremen of each group would report to one another and report up to their supervisors. And it felt a lot less like the ideals that Ripley had initially founded the community on. And the makeup of the group, as you can imagine, changed as well as a consequence. And so while the initial community at Brook Farm had been made up almost entirely of Boston intellectuals, now tradespeople and working class people began to fill in the gaps that were left by those that had departed during the reorganization. Ripley was very quick to point out that children from all walks of life were equally successful in the farm school, and that the discourse among the adults was as robust and lively as ever, despite the diversity of backgrounds that now lived there. So he was really trying to point out, like, no, my ideas really do work. We're all equal here, and that's awesome. But at the same time, he had lost a lot of the people that originally bought into his plan.
In 1845, Brook Farm began producing a periodical called The Harbinger. It was dedicated to Fourierism and the philosophy of utopian society. Ripley hoped that this new project was going to bring them some money.
And by this point, there were more than 100 people living at Brook Farm, so it had grown pretty substantially. And Ripley wanted to construct a new building that would house all of them. At this point, they still had the hive, but they had several other smaller houses. And he was really counting on the periodical to make some money.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
So work began on the Great Community House, which was to be called the Phalanstery.
With the increase in Fourierism's popularity, Brook Farm and other utopian communities were starting to be viewed with more and more suspicion by the outside world. Rumors were spreading about sexual promiscuity and depravity, and while these rumors were not true of Brook Farm, they were seated in Fourier's writings, in which he did advocate for sort of a free love model, similar to what we think of with the 1960s. In any case, the gossip about this behavior in West Roxbury was so devastating to the school's enrollment, and consequently to Brook Farm's finances.
Yeah, when your primary source of income, you know, loses most of its it's the checks that are coming in, you very quickly find yourself in a lot of trouble. And there was just more trouble to come at this point. So as times got leaner, tensions understandably grew among the Brook Farm residents. One resident started hosting an outdoor Sunday service each week, and this actually caused a big rift between those who were really excited and welcome to this idea and those who had moved to Brook Farm because of its secular roots. And we should mention that religion wasn't forbidden or even unusual at Brook Farm, but organized religion had not been a part of the farm's foundation. People were certainly welcome to be spiritual and worship in whatever way they wanted, but the fact that this person was now hosting services really rankled some people.
And then to make matters worse, smallpox hit the community after one of the members caught it while visiting relatives in Boston and got back before he developed symptoms. About 30% of the group had to be quarantined, and then the healthy people in the group weren't able to work on the farm because they were having to care for the sick. Several pupils were removed from the school by their families, which also reduced the little bit of income that Brook Farm had. By this point, there were 4 mortgages taken out on the property.
So they were in really bad financial straits. And it only got worse because just after the smallpox outbreak, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't think they lost anybody during that. They just lost productivity. They had very few deaths at Brook Farm, which is kind of a happy face in the midst of sort of this bad stuff going on. But just after that smallpox outbreak, Nathaniel Hawthorne, who had left 6 months after it was founded, took legal action against Brook Farm to try to get his initial investment back since he didn't stay. And there had been a provision in the original contracts of Brook Farm that people could, if they gave enough notice, get their investment back if they stayed a shortened period of time. So he was within his rights. And unfortunately, there were just no funds to repay him. Ripley actually agreed, yes, he's completely within his bounds to want his money back. I just don't have that money. And it didn't help that Brook Farm had also lost its primary philanthropic supporters. The people that were giving money to these utopian communities had decided they were going to give them to other communities that looked like they might have greater success.
In a last-ditch effort to breathe life back into the community, Ripley and the Brook Farm leadership pushed forward on completion of the phalanstery in 1846. This was yet another case of the characteristic and misguided optimism that had given Brook Farm such promise at the beginning, but was also its undoing. It's really like any tale of the chronic failed dreamer, where you just keep thinking, just one more thing, we'll turn this around.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, everything that you look at, it's like, no, we're going to start publishing this paper. People will buy it and then we'll be fine. No, the school is going to keep us afloat. But then, you know, just one thing after another, he kept thinking would save them, and it never did. And then to kind of kick them while they were down, they threw a party to celebrate what was going to be the completion of the new structure. It wasn't completed, but they were kind of excited that they were moving forward and close to the end. And this was on March 3rd of 1846. And during the party, a fire broke out and consumed the entire building. So the phalanstery was completely decimated as they were trying to celebrate it. And it was an unfinished structure, and it had not been insured. So as it burned, so did the dream of Brook Farm, because $7,000 had been spent building the structure, which had turned to ashes. And it was thought that they were going to need another $3,000 just to finish it. But of course, that money never got spent because it wasn't there to finish.
So they were basically out on their investment of the building.
Completely.
Completely. So not having to spend that $3,000 more was not
really going to help them, no. So that was really the final nail in the community's financial coffin. And it took its toll on the already lagging morale of the people that had stuck it out and were trying to keep things going. So within just a few months, there were only a few dozen people left at Brook Farm. And George Ripley, even though he was still living there on the property, had kind of already turned his focus to the New England Fournier Society. He really stopped worrying about keeping it going because he kind of knew what was going to happen.
Toward the end of 1846, the Brook Farm library collection was sold at auction. And then in 1847, the bankruptcy filing for Brook Farm wrapped up. And in August of 1847, it was officially disbanded. So Ripley's transcendentalist utopia only lasted for 6 years.
And while Brook Farm wasn't sustainable long term, it really did have a pretty significant influence on many social movements going on at the time, including abolitionism and the women's rights movement.
According to Linda Swift, who we referenced earlier, 14 marriages could track their roots back to the fellowship at Brook Farm, one of which actually took place there, and most of those appear to have been happy.
Another interesting point is that the community had what could be considered a prototype of the modern daycare, where the few parents among the group could leave their children with caregivers for the day while they set to their work, which had really never been done before, at least on an organized level.
Nathaniel Hawthorne, who probably never got back his initial investment, wrote a fictionalized version of his time at Brook Farm called Blithedale Romance. It's clear from it that he did not enjoy this experiment.
As for Ripley, he went on to become the literary critic for the New York Tribune, and he held that job until he died in 1880.
After Brook Farm was abandoned, the former dairy farm found other uses. It was used as a poorhouse, as a Civil War training camp, and as an orphanage.
In 1977, Brook Farm was designated a Boston landmark. That same year, the Hive, which was still standing, burned down. In 1984, arson took the house on the property that had been named after Margaret Fuller, even though she had never lived there.
In 1988, the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation acquired the Brook Farm site. It lists the lands as a National Historic Landscape, and the buildings are all gone.
In her 1900 book entitled Brook Farm, Its Members, Scholars, and Visitors, Linda Swift, who we referenced earlier, says of the Brook Farm community, like some ill-contrived play, the Brook Farm phalanx lingered during one more act after all the essential dramatic elements were exhausted. So even though it kind of sputtered out at the end and it had a lot of problems, it's still kind of referred to when people talk about it as sort of a success in terms of it being a successful experiment. Like, I think a lot was learned from it. And from a sociological standpoint, I know people study it and kind of turn over and examine what was right about it and what was wrong. And it did have some pretty interesting influences on society at the time. So in that regard, you could count it a success. There were societal reforms linked to some seeds sowed there. And it's so fascinating.
Yeah. And it was pretty revolutionary that everyone, regardless of their sex or their age or their race, was going to be treated the same way.
Yeah.
That's not really how 1840 was working.
And there are many, many stories. I mean, you could almost launch a podcast just about Brook Farm and talk about individual stories of people and events that happened there, because there are many, many of them. And most of the people that had lived there really spoke pretty well of it, even though there had been problems. So it's a fascinating concept to think about. I have to wonder if someone tried a similar thing today, if it would work.
Well, and I know a couple of people that have lived essentially on communes at some point in their life. None of them for their entire life. Like, it always seems to have been this 3 to 5 year stint at a commune. Yeah. Yeah. My early memories are on the commune, and then my parents left.
Yeah. Yeah. There are many cases of failed communes, but I think a lot of times they implode in a much more dramatic way. This one kind of, like I said,
kind
it fizzled out.
Yeah.
It was mostly about money, I think, even though there were some ideological shifts throughout its life. Really, the money was what killed it.
Yeah. Well, and even if you think you're prepared for the work, the manual work, like if you are an intellectual person who most of your life has been relatively privileged, then the sheer amount of manual labor required just to raise your own food,
it's a shock.
Is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It puts a lot of things in perspective.
Yes, indeed. So that's Brook Farm.
Thank you so much for joining us on this Saturday. If you have heard an email address or a Facebook URL or something similar over the course of today's episode, since it is from the archive, that might be out of date now. You can email us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. And you can find us all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Parrot Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota bZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.